So, like all great thinkers, Marx ends up being saddled with responsibility for the very category that he's taking under critical consideration. And so he's mistaken to be an advocate, whereas in fact he's a critic, and that's with respect to the so-called labor theory of value. Labor theory of value. That Marx doesn't have a labor theory of value, but he's rather a critic of the labor theory of value, and not merely a critic of the labor theory of value, but rather he's mounting a critique of the labor theory of value. Namely, how it might point beyond itself, labor as value. And an analogy would be Friedrich Nietzsche. You ask most people about Nietzsche as a philosopher, they'll say that he's a nihilist philosopher. Whereas in fact what he was doing was not advocating nihilism, but rather trying to diagnose nihilism as a symptom, specifically as a symptom that demanded a self-overcoming or a Selbstaufhebung, the self-fulfillment and self-negation. And I think that that kind of turn of phrase from Nietzsche, which both is and is not in the tradition of German idealism that Marx is in, is helpful for thinking about Marx's approach to labor as value, that he looks forward to the self-overcoming of labor as value. So, with respect to this, we're talking about not a positive theory of labor as value, but a critical theory of labor as value, and specifically, labor as value is in crisis in capitalism, for Marx. In other words, there's a crisis of labor as value in capitalism, which Marx regards as a symptom of a possible and necessary change. So let me say something about labor, and then I'll say something about value. And I know we're going to have a presentation on Hannah Arendt on the human condition, or on Vita Activa, which is what it was titled in German. The distinction that Arendt makes is helpful in this regard. So Arendt distinguishes between activity, work, which is transformative activity. Not all activity is transformative, but work is activity that is transformative. And it's transformative not only of the object that's being worked on, but indeed it's transformative of the subject. And then there's labor, which is work, it's transformative activity in society. In other words, it's the value of work, that not all work is labor, just as not all activity is work. So a famous formulation of Marx's with respect to this is the emancipation of labor, you know, what he's inheriting from the greater socialist and communist tradition, the idea of the emancipation of society demands the emancipation of labor. But in fact, for Marx, that is in fulfillment of already what is the desideratum of bourgeois society. In other words, bourgeois society is itself understood as the emancipation of labor, the emancipation of transformative activity of work and its valuation in society. Just to point out the history for this, John Locke, who's the theorist of the Glorious Revolution in England, really the consolidation of the bourgeois revolution in England in the late 17th century, had formulated that the right to property was grounded in labor. In other words, that the actual right to property was not a right of might, but it's a right of labor. It's something that needs to be recognized in society. And in the Great French Revolution of 1789, the most prevalent revolutionary pamphlet in 1789 was the Abbé Sieyès's What is the Third Estate, in which he talked about the estates in the Estates General that were being called in the crisis of the Ancien Régime. The first estate, what does it do? It prays, because the first estate is the church. The second estate, the aristocracy, what does it do? It fights. The third estate, however, the commoners, which is 95% of the population at least, what do they do? they work, according to Abbe Sieyès. And he says, under the old regime, the third estate was nothing, but now it shall be everything. In other words, the value of work, which was negligible in terms of the organization of society in medievalism, in Christianity, the activity of the commoners counted for nothing, but now it will be everything. It will be the principle of society. So indeed, the bourgeois revolution was announced in terms of the rights of labor and the social recognition of work. So now I want to turn to Marx's, the passage from the Grundrisse that we had. Just to put this issue of bourgeois society, labor, on the table. So this is Marx. The ancient conception in which man always appears in however narrowly national, religious, or political a definition as the aim of production seems very much more exalted than the modern world in which production is the aim of man and wealth the aim of production. So what he's doing there is he's engaging in a reversal of means and ends. In other words, at one time, he thinks, in the ancient conception, meaning everything that came before the modern, that a definite form of humanity, or definite forms of humanity in the caste system, was the aim of the activity in society. In other words, everything was geared towards producing a definite way of life. Whereas now, production is not a means towards a definite end, but rather production has become an end in itself. In other words, the very aim is production itself. He says, in fact, however, when the narrow bourgeois form, the aim of production is wealth, has been peeled away, what is wealth? If not the universality of needs, capacities, enjoyments, productive powers, etc., of individuals produced in universal exchange. So I want to highlight there that production and exchange are actually inextricable for Marx. In other words, production in this sense is a social form, and exchange is the form of the social production. What, if not the full development of human control over the forces of nature, those of his own nature, as well as those of so-called nature? What, if not the absolute elaboration of his creative dispositions without any preconditions other than antecedent historical evolution, which make the totality of this evolution, i.e., the evolution of all human powers as such, unmeasured by any previously established yardstick, an end in itself? What is this, if not a situation where man does not reproduce in any determined form, but produces his totality, where he does not seek to remain something formed by the past, but is in the absolute movement of becoming? In bourgeois political economy, and in the epoch of production to which it corresponds, this complete elaboration of what lies within man appears as the total alienation and the destruction of all fixed, one-sided purposes, as the sacrifice of the end in itself to a wholly external compulsion. Hence, in one way, the childlike world of the ancients appears superior, and this is so insofar as we seek for closed shape, form, and established limitation. The ancients provide a narrow satisfaction, whereas the modern world leaves us unsatisfied, or where it appears to be satisfied with itself, is vulgar and mean. So I want to unpack that a little bit to get at what I'm trying to address, namely production for the sake of production. Production for the sake of production. That this is the bourgeois epoch's conception, not only theoretically, but in practice, of freedom. In other words, freedom is production for the sake of production in this open-ended manner, the absolute movement of becoming. But what we have, according to Marx, in the era of capitalism, is that this production for the sake of production has seemed to appear satisfied with itself and has become vulgar and mean. So the distinction that I'd like to make is the idea of society as a society of production for production's sake, distinct from what we have in capitalism, which is not production for the sake of production, but rather production for the sake of value. Right, and this brings us back to the issue of labor as value. Does Marx have a labor theory of value, or rather, does he have a critique of labor as value? In other words, has a society that is pursuing production for the sake of production actually outgrown labor as value? In a way that, again, the bourgeois conception is this kind of Promethean notion of human labor as productive. So I wanted to invoke there the classic definition that Marx has of capitalism, namely that capitalism, the capitalist mode of production, is a contradiction. In other words, as a mode of production, it's a contradiction in itself. It's a contradiction between bourgeois social relations, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the industrial forces of production. The industrial forces of production are outstripping and pointing beyond the bourgeois social relations. And usually, traditionally, this has been understood, that bourgeois social relations are usually understood as the private property in the market, private property in the means of production, and the market form of the exchange of goods and the realization of value and capital. What I'd like to offer is, in fact, that the bourgeois social relations are not private property in the means of production by the capitalists, but in fact, the value of labor. In other words, wage labor as a social relation. That's what's holding back the industrial forces of production from Marx. And again, this is the distinction of production for the sake of production, in which case, for instance, for someone like Adam Smith, labor as value is a means to the end. In other words, if you want to maximize production for the sake of production, you can use labor as value to mediate a society effectively to emancipate production. What Smith could not have foreseen, but which is Marx's concern, is what happens with the Industrial Revolution. In other words, when labor as value ceases to be an adequate means for emancipating production, ceases to be adequate to the task of freeing production in this unlimited way that he calls for here. So in that respect, the issue is how labor as value has itself generated and continues to generate these industrial forces of production. In other words, continues to generate a crisis, a situation pointing beyond itself, how labor in its own activity in society points beyond itself, points beyond the bourgeois conception of humanity as homo faber and homo economicus. So the bourgeois conception is that there's been this long history of human development from the Paleolithic hunter-gatherers up through settled agriculture, subsistence agriculture, and now into bourgeois production, in which humans are the producing animal, they make things, homo faber, and they produce with increasing efficiency, homo economicus. So the history of humanity as the history of homo faber, homo economicus, which is of course not actually true of past forms of humanity, but is the way that bourgeois society appropriates all of human history to itself, so that it appears that the hunter-gatherers have a division of labor, for example. Did they have a division of labor? No, they actually just had a gendered way of relating to the totemic species, in which the men hunted and the women gathered. It's not a division of labor, it's not a mode of production. Did peasants in the long history of traditional civilization practicing subsistence agriculture, was that a mode of production? Right? Can we say that agriculture was their mode of absolute movement of becoming? Not really, but from the bourgeois standpoint, it looks as if this is the case. It looks as if what humans have always been doing is perfecting production, perfecting their production with respect to nature and also their production with respect to themselves. That has not always been the case. It's rather the case in the emancipation of society in the bourgeois era, and it will not always be the case.
5 minutes.
So for Marx, the crisis of capitalism is actually marking, as he puts it, the potential end of prehistory and the beginning of true human history. What that would mean is that, in fact, we would cast the history of the human species that is projected back from bourgeois society as the history of production, as the history of, in a sense, history of human labor, that would be cast into prehistory if socialism and communism were attained. In other words, we would transcend this conception of human nature of the bourgeois epoch. And he thinks that this has happened precisely through the demand in the industrial era of workers for the value of their labor. In other words, that I think what came up earlier was formal and real subsumption, that distinction, and the distinction, we might say, that's related, not identical, distinction between absolute and relative surplus value. That, of course, these are not discrete periods in time, but rather are both constitutive and then reproduce a contradiction in capitalism, meaning that we always have formal and real, an interaction of formal and real subsumption. We always have an interaction of absolute and relative surplus value. We always have the paradox of overwork and unemployment. We always have sweatshops and robots. And in a sense, we've always had that from the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Now, Marx thinks that this has come about precisely because of the political crisis caused by the Industrial Revolution and by the workers' own class struggle against the capitalists in the Industrial Revolution. In other words, Chartists in England, or the rising of the weavers in Lyon in France, like this period of the early 19th century, at the close of the first phase of the Industrial Revolution, that in fact things like wage levels, subsistence levels, norms for all kinds of aspects of social reproduction in society, the reproduction of the workforce in society, are, according to Marx in the Working Day chapter of Das Kapital, they're extremely variable. In other words, they're the product of political struggle, they're the product of cultural, social norms, legal reforms, etc. So for instance, it became unchristian to exploit people. So it was Christian pastors in England who led the fight to get the workers to have at least one day off, right? Sunday. They need to have Sunday off. It's unchristian to work them on the Sabbath. And it became unchristian to work women and children as they were being worked in the factory era. These are all not part of the economic logic of labor as value, but are actually extrinsic to the economic logic of labor as value. They are external constraints that are imposed for political, cultural, social reasons. And that it's this that in fact motivates and impels the introduction of machines into the factory process. So I wanted to, I can come around to my end point then quickly, which is I want to sort of conclude on this paradoxical formulation that Marx has with respect to a world beyond labor. He says that work will go from life's prime need to becoming life's prime want. In other words, we will no longer work because we need to, out of the false necessity of the valorization process of capital. In other words, the capital itself has to justify itself with respect to labor as value. We will no longer work because we need to in that respect. We will overcome that social necessity for work. And rather, we will work because we want to. In other words, the degree to which humans engage in transformative activity, activity that transforms nature and that transforms ourselves, it will be because we want to, not because we need to. and that therefore we will have transcended the value of work in society as we now experience it. In other words, we will transcend labor as value. So we won't necessarily transcend work, but we will transcend labor. We will transcend labor as a social principle. Thank you.
I have to really congratulate all of you because everybody fits the time. The next presentation will be two students, as Chris was already referring to, on the regarding the human condition of Hannah Arendt by Sarah El-Alawi and Aurel Denis.
Hannah Arendt is an American.
Stop. Microphone.
Yeah, you need the mic.